I think artificial intelligence is being a force multiplier with these providers. So extending their reach, making sure that they're more efficient in what they do, and giving them tools that prior to AI were unattainable for them to achieve.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. Bridging the gap between physical health care and behavioral health care is one of the most complex problems we face today with our healthcare organizations. Our guest today is Chris Molaro, CEO and co-founder of Neuroflow. Neuroflow exists to make sure no one who needs behavioral health support falls through the cracks. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Chris, our audience is always interested in the story, and I've read your story. I want to hear your story. Your story is amazing. So why don't you start with graduating West Point?
That's a good place to start. Sometimes I'm surprised I made it through those 4 years, but I did and was commissioned a second lieutenant. And the amazing part of that experience was it set you up to lead soldiers, to be a leader in the Army. And Second Lieutenant Molaro was actually just north of you, where you are in Dallas. I was in Oklahoma in the artillery school and getting ready to take lead of my platoon, which was about 3 hours south in central Texas, Fort Hood, Texas. And took command of a platoon, had 40 soldiers under my leadership, and we deployed overseas in support of the operations there in Iraq. And it was just it was an experience where you learned how to be humble, but also be confident with what you were doing and lead an organization. Make a long story short, we spent a year overseas, 280 combat missions. And as you can imagine, a lot of people come back home stressed, sleep issues, anxiety, PTSD, and so forth. And I had a number of soldiers, both in my platoon and then the broader unit, that were struggling with this stuff. And I had one soldier that fell through the cracks, and we lost him to his battle with depression when he died by suicide. And obviously the loss in life is a tragedy, and the fact that his family and the unit lost a really good man. The more frustrating piece for me was, we didn't realize until after the fact, but he never actually went to get the care that he was referred to. And so here you have somebody that's in physical care. He's not in, you know, he's raising his hand saying he needs support with sleep and, you know, with all these sorts of things. And he was referred to. And then, by the way, in the military, care is free, so cost isn't a barrier. And he just never went to that care. We know that after the fact. Like, we should have been able to do something before the fact.
Such a tragedy. It's terrible to hear that.
Bob, the reality is, though, that's a tragedy for me personally, because I've dealt with that. That's a tragedy for his family and his kids and the military. But when you zoom out, you realize that this is not just a military thing. This affects men, women, Medicare, Medicaid, doesn't matter where you live. And we could get more into that, but related to my story, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. I loved the military, but I transitioned when I was a captain. I transitioned into the reserves and moved to Philadelphia to go to business school, which is where I found myself 7 years ago. And that's where we started the company. That's my background in a nutshell.
So you met your co-founding partner at Wharton?
I did. Yeah, I was at Wharton. He was in the engineering.
I'm a clinical professor here at University of Texas, Dallas, and we have a program. It's called the Alliance for Physician Leadership, and we bring in physicians to get their MBA. And in one of our courses in our strategy class, we run a little Shark Tank type scenario.
Actually, yeah, there was a business plan competition, which I guess was Shark Tanky, that we were like, hey, this sounds pretty cool. $10,000 prize came with it, which was a lot of money for somebody not making any money at the time. And we submitted it. Lost, didn't win the $10,000. But what we did learn was that we had a lot of fun doing that. And on the need perspective, we learned that, dang, there's a huge need here in behavioral health that's not being addressed. And We took that lessons from the, losing that one business plan competition, submitted to another one a few months later, won that, and then we were off to the races.
So was it Neuroflow from the beginning? That's the name of the company that you guys started?
It was, yeah, Neuroflow. And it's funny, we weren't even a real business yet, but when we won that business plan competition, University of Pennsylvania wouldn't write either of us a personal check. They had to write a business a check. So we had to get an business bank account opened just so that we can get the winnings from the business plan competition, which is funny.
It's a great way to start a business, is have some money flowing in the door. That's not bad at all. Okay. So the compelling need, it became very clear to you that there was this big gap between behavioral health and physical health. A huge gap there. And by the way, before we get into describing, I'm confused sometimes. I'm hearing the word behavioral health. And what happened to mental being or mental illness or emotional health or cognitive health? There's almost so many different terms. How do we center in on behavioral health? Is that the right word that we should all be starting to use and understand better? Because that's confusing as an individual. I don't want to tell somebody that I have chronic depression. I don't want to tell them I have mental illness. I don't know what words to use if I want to try to express myself in some form or fashion. What do you suggest?
First of all, I think they're like a Venn diagram. So they're different slightly, but they're all related. The way I think about it, and there might be listeners that will correct me or have different opinions, but the way that we look at it and our chief medical officer, who's a psychiatrist, looks at it, is mental illness is the diagnosable like DSM code. So are you diagnosed with depression or schizophrenia or bipolar and so forth? And those are important diagnoses to have just like any other physical illness. The reason why we don't use the word illness and we focus more on the health usage of mental or behavioral health is because everybody has mental health, just like everybody has physical health. It just matter where you on the health spectrum is what it is. You could be not depressed, not anxious, and you still have mental health. It's just really healthy mental health in that case. And so that, I think, is a big distinction of using health versus illness. And then the difference between mental and behavioral health is less diagnosable and more about the actions that, you know, that as people, we partake in every day that lead to our overall health. For example, do you smoke or not? That's a behavior, right? That's not, you're not diagnosed with like you can't be diagnosed as a smoker, but you have a behavior of whether or not you're choosing to smoke. You're a big runner, Bob, as am I like running too. Getting up in the morning and going for a run is a behavior that we choose that. And so behavioral health is steeped in literally, it's the behavior that we engage in that may or may not be impacted by the mental health component, but that's how we think about the difference. Does that make sense?
Very good. That really helps a lot. I know that I just recently started yoga the last couple of months. Runners hate yoga because we look like the Tin Man from the Wizard of Oz. And we're so stiff and we say, oil can loosen us up. But I've learned there's a mental element to the yoga, which is something I've never experienced before. So I'm sure there's a lot of things personally that we deal with daily that addresses anxiety and stress and depression. And I guess some people have it in a chronic sense. And those are the things that I guess are pretty difficult. They may be undetected and maybe underaddressed as well in the marketplace. But getting back on the theme here of this type of care, I know that you're aware of primary care and how it's starting to trend into value-based care.
Right. And
I think our audience is catching on to value-based care as well, that a lot of the primary care people are no longer just a fee-for-service model, but they're really trying to look at the quality of care. They're trying to look at the performance of the doctors themselves and the patient experience. We're really trying to integrate this care, meaning that we look at every aspect of the person's care, their physical, their mental, their behavior, and their social needs. But that doesn't happen today, I don't think. How do you close this gap where you go to one type of doctor for your mental care and a different type of doctor for your physical care? How do you start to change that? That seems like a huge undertaking, Chris.
It does, and it is. And I think there's a lot in what you said. So let's unpack it. So
okay.
Before jumping right into value-based care, I think it's important to talk about the connection of physical and mental health care. And to your exact point, for the longest time, it's always been, I'm going to get my physical health treated over here, and I'm going to get my, and those people wear white coats and have stethoscopes around their neck and so forth. And I'm going to then get my mental health treated over here. And those people have weird glasses and beards, and you lay down on a couch when seeing them, and they're completely different places. And so forth. You think about them differently. And it sounds trite now, but it's just, that's not the case. And that's not the way we need to treat those things, because they don't happen in silos. And that's one of the things that we have to recognize and start to appreciate. The good news is, I think that trend is happening. And what I mean by that is, if somebody has, we'll use chronic pain as an example. If you have chronic pain every day because you just got a surgery and you're having trouble getting out of bed because your back hurts, when you have trouble getting out of bed because your back hurts every day and you're dealing with this pain, of course it's going to lead to risk of depression or anxiety around not being able to provide for your family, a slew of reasons. But chronic pain leads to depression, anxiety, mental health issues, and vice versa. Then depressed, you feel helpless. You're going to do less of the stretches that you need to get that pain better. You're going to feel more hopeless, and it's going to actually lead to worse pain over time. And worse pain then leads to more depression. You get in this negative cycle. Any really chronic illness, you could say, diabetes and depression has been well documented. So someone with diabetes, it has a toll on your quality of life. And so you're less than adherent to take your medication, and you're going to eat less healthy. You're going to be less active. All of those things contribute to making your diabetes worse. Diabetes is worse than your, and know for a fact, there's no debating this, just looking at the claims data, that when somebody has diabetes and somebody has diabetes and depression, the latter person with the comorbidity of the two is 4 to 6 times more expensive on an annual basis. They visit the ED more. They're on more medications. They're just overall less healthy. And so if we're going to treat their diabetes, we have to treat the mental health component of it. The first step of doing that is being able to identify it. And that's where then we get into the value-based care discussion. If a doctor is going to be at risk for their cost of care related to the diabetes, and they're not accounting for the mental health component, they're doing themselves and the patient a disservice by not treating the whole person. Does that make sense?
I've interviewed some value-based providers like ChinMed, and they have a panel of maybe 400 or 500 patients per doctor. The doctor has the cell phone number of their patients, and the patient has a cell phone number of the doctor, and they are at risk. They manage the risk component of it. So if they can get in front of the risk aspect, they can basically kill the monster while it's little. They can get in front of some of these issues. But I got to tell you, Chris, for me, I feel like it's an experiment of one, and maybe it's not an experiment of one, that there's some bigger sets of data that we can look at. I'm physically active. I got an Apple Watch. It keeps track of just about everything. It tells me when to stand up, when to go to bed. It looks at my sleep quality. It does all this stuff. And my primary care doctor, he's never, ever asked anything about my data or my information like that. I just go in, get the checkup, and leave. It seems like there's a disconnect there. He's not been equipped. He's not been enabled, if you will, to buy into this concept. And I don't know why. Maybe it just doesn't fit their mode of doing business. And how do you overcome things like that? Or how do you start to close that gap a little bit?
It's a huge challenge, Bob. In the primary care doctor's defense, they are asked to do too much in too little amount of time. And so they're really inundated by all these different requirements, like charting all the time. Like patient care is almost like fourth or fifth on the priority list when it comes down to all their administrative needs. And then to add in additional data points, it becomes cumbersome, to say the least. Plus, a lot of the cases, especially related to behavioral health stuff, primary care providers feel ill-equipped. I don't want to ask Bob if he feels depressed or how he's doing mentally, because I'm afraid if he says yes, I don't know what the next step is after that. I know how to treat his hypertension. If he goes, yeah, I'm having marital troubles, I can't sleep. Now it's in a world where I don't know how to address that. And there it's a shame. It's a shame, because we know that the mental stuff is impacting the hypertension, right? And the problem is pervasive. But your question is a good one, which is how you address it.
I know the doctors now, they say in that physical exam, they've got a checkbox to do. I think they get extra points for it. They say, are you depressed? And I go, no, not really. The doctor says, don't you watch the evening news? Yeah, I do watch the evening news. Isn't that depressing? Well, as a matter of fact, it is. He checks the box and I'm out the door. So we know, though, I think we can deduce so far, Chris, that if you stop to look at this value-based care, it should include one of the pillars of value-based care should be what? It should be mental, behavioral, medical care as well, right?
Absolutely. I'm a firm believer that you can't achieve true value-based care without accounting for behavioral health of somebody and getting them to the right level of care. Because to your point, even if today the primary care doctor is checking the box, which in many cases during an annual wellness visit or during an office visit, they will do that. Either the patient, and I'm guilty of this, is not the most honest in those. Are you feeling all right? Yeah, I'm feeling all right. Or if I'm honest and I do raise my hand and say, yeah, I need help. The evening news is depressing. They just send me to, it's a one size fits all. They just refer me over to psychiatry. And there's not enough psychiatrists to take care of the demand. So you get these really long wait times. So helping the primary care provider understand the appropriate course of action related to behavioral will enable that value-based care discussion that we're talking about.
Okay. So as the value-based starts to blossom, get larger, it goes into this population health model. And that's where I think you bring a lot of value when you start to look at behavioral health analytics and intelligence. Population health, for the benefit of our audience here, that's when we start to look at a larger population, but trying to find out who needs what help now, who needs what kind of help now, and how do we get that to them before it gets bad. The population health model, you guys start to kick in with some of your analytics to find these people that need behavioral health. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. So it's not just being preventative. It's also helping to identify the people that are at the top of the pyramid in terms of risk. So, okay. And risk stratifying them. So we take a bunch of different data sources, all of which is owned by, it's all protected under HIPAA. It's owned by the patients. We keep that in a secure environment is within the health system, but everything from claims data to EHR encounter data to then patient reported data. So like you think about when you write a doctor a note or a self-reported measure through a text message you might send them, we're able to collect all of that data to create a risk profile for the patient panel so they could see, okay, Bob is mildly anxious. Chris, on the other hand, is more severely anxious. These are the appropriate things to do with each of them as your patients.
Okay, so when we stop to think about getting people prepared for this, once agreed, it's a big job trying to make a change like this. But you talk about enablers, how to get started, some of the best practices. How do you get ready? What are some of the ready assessments? And what type of integration models do you have? Have you guys worked through these things? Because there's no magic button called artificial intelligence. We'll touch base on that in a few minutes, but there's no magic button that cures all these problems. But there's probably a whole lot of things that are human-driven. Some of these enablers, can you discuss some of the things that you do to get people ready for this new approach?
Yeah. So first of all, you asked this earlier, and I don't know if I answered it entirely, which was how do you get this stuff adopted by the providers? Going back to the notion that providers have already too much to worry about, you have to be able to integrate into their workflows and do so seamlessly. If you add 30 seconds worth of work to their workflow, they're just not going to adopt it because they can't do it in the time that they have. And so we work with them on designing to, one, understand their workflow more clearly, and then understand what systems they're using currently so we can integrate and inject ourselves in the findings in a seamless way where if we do it right, we should save them time as opposed to add time to their docket. And when you have to do that in a very intentional way, but when you do that, it works really well. And so to me, the first step is explaining to them what the model is and showing them kind of the different flavors based on their population, what systems they already have in place, and really taking a consultative approach with them rather than a one size fits all. And when you do that, they can adopt it because it's making them more efficient, not less efficient.
It almost sounds like a model where you're taking someone who's already pretty good in shape. They've got some good ideas, but you're getting ready for the Olympics. You're going to get in there and you're going to show them some new things to improve on what they're already doing so they can better address this in a more integrated fashion. So that sounds like a really powerful direction to move forward to. I want to touch base a little bit on some artificial intelligent tools and things that you guys have been looking at. I want to refer our audience to Bridging the Gap, a Neuroflow podcast that you guys do. Bridging the Gap, I love the name because what you're trying to do is bridge the gap that we're talking about here between the behavioral health and the physical health. And I really enjoyed listening to Julia Kastner on one of the podcasts. And she was talking about some of the new AI innovations and some of the R&D strategy that your data science team is putting to place. Tell me more about how you guys are using large language models and natural language processing to find signals in the noise of all this mental health problem.
If you just go through it, Bob, this is what's so exciting. You're looking at all these claims data, all of this, the EHR encounter data, all the free form text that a patient is writing. And it, in many cases, they're disparate systems. And even if they were integrated together, we're still talking about billions and trillions of data points. No person can look through all of that to find needs within a population. And so that's where AI could come into the mix, which is, right, AI is not, we're not seeking to replace humans here. There are companies that are creating chatbots and stuff like that can be in place of a therapist. That's a longer conversation for another time. Our model and strategy is not to replace the humans here. It's to help make, to superpower them, to superpower the providers so that they can have more of a reach and do things that are traditionally out of their purview and signal to them when somebody needs an extra level of care and then be able to act appropriately on that. And it's the hair of my neck stands up when we talk about how our NLP has identified somebody that might be suicidal. That alert goes to a care manager. The care manager then reaches out to that person. And if you hear the testimony from that call, the person says, yeah, I was trying to get an appointment. I couldn't get in for 30 days. I'm an alcoholic that started drinking again. And I'm at a loss for options. I had a plan to kill myself and I didn't know anybody was listening. That care manager was able to de-escalate that crisis, get that person to care and do a handoff. So rather than waiting 30 days, got them in the next day. And again, that would have been a situation that we would never have known about unless AI was able to pick that up and allowed that care manager to be proactive.
So that suicidality, which was written in a journal, would never have been found by the clinical expert, but the AI could determine that and find that and extract that information.
That's right.
I tell you, that's absolutely amazing to me. I took a 7-week course. I wanted to sharpen the saw. So I took one of these 7-week courses that MIT offers on AI and healthcare. And I learned about a number of what I call superhuman things that AI does. Now, we all know there's a lot of practical things, I'd call operational efficiency things that AI can help us with, and that's being exploited a lot. But some of these superhuman things, and I'm putting what you're doing in one of those superhuman categories, that there's no way in the world that you could collectively find this information and work on it and make it actionable without the help of some of these powerful tools like this. There's probably a lot of other areas. There's lots of signals probably in these electronic health records. There's probably a lot of signals out there in these claims. There's probably a lot of signals out there in this pharmaceutical data. And what about the wearable data? I've got this Apple Watch that gathers all of this data. Are you guys looking at all in terms of finding more information and more tools that can be extracted from these wearables?
We are. And as a matter of fact, like wearables, by the way, we do that today. So if you're invited to your health system, your provider invites you to their Neuroflow instance. And I say their Neuroflow instance because it's all white labeled to be the health system's, their product, their version of the product. So it's their brand first and foremost to build that trust with the patient. If you download and you're using their instance of it, it will ask you if you want to pair your wearable to it. You get points that could be redeemed for gift cards for doing so. And then your heart rate, it tracks your exercise level, which are all indications of somebody's mental health. If you're a runner and all of a sudden you stop running for 2 weeks, that could just be because you're on a break or you're recovering from something, or it could be because you're depressed and you're not wanting to run. And so we take in all these different data points and help create a risk profile picture for each person that then the providers can act on and treat the person more holistically.
I love hearing that. I have a wife that says, why don't you go on a run? Get out of here. Yeah. Right. So she's my sensor there that's not on the Apple Watch. So that's an interesting concept. So you're going to see more and more, would I say, intelligent behavior being derived from these wearables going forward. That's definitely going to be, I think we've got all these opportunities to be exposed to stress and anxiety, all the social media activities out there, all the political discourse that's out there. We've got to find a way to somehow identify some of these metrics for success. So tell us about some of the clients, some of the things that you've done. How have you seen your hard work start to pay dividends?
I gave that anecdotal example about that one patient that was in a crisis, was having trouble getting an appointment. That was with the ACO, Accountable Care Organization, which talked about value-based care. That's what ACOs are there for, is to enable value-based care between a payer and a system. That was up in Northern Jersey with Atlantic Health System. Dr. Jim Barr is their chief medical officer and has publicly spoken about that. That's an N of one, but we've done that now with a much larger population. Prudential Insurance. So Prudential, people are like, Prudential is not a healthcare organization. Prudential does disability insurance. And you know, someone's on disability for whatever reason. When they're on disability, there's a higher likelihood of either loneliness or depression, PTSD related to whatever they're on disability for. And that mental health component, when unidentified, impacts their ability to recover, their time to recover, and their time to get back to work. And so as a part of our partnership with Prudential, anybody on disability gets monitored through Neuroflow. We also have self-help tools in the engagement platform, like videos and tips on how to de-stress and stuff like that. And for the same thing, the algorithms identify people that are on disability that are struggling to return, and their care managers are empowered to reach out to them. They're not live yet, but we just announced a partnership with Intermountain Health, large integrated delivery network in the Rockies, to support. We're starting with their primary care clinics in Colorado. So we're really excited about this. I think more and more systems are catching on to the need to use data for integrating behavioral health.
Intermountain's a great value-based representation. So that's awesome. That's a real, really big thing. So you're working with payers, you're working with providers, you're working with the government as well?
We are. It's interesting. The government sales process is very different, but the value proposition on how we work with the government is no different than working with the payers and the systems. If you think about it, Bob, the Veteran Affairs Hospital System, which as a veteran I'm treated at, is just a large integrated delivery network. They're sort of an Intermountain Health on steroids nationally. And so the workflows are very similar. The systems we work with are very similar. They're just a giant payer provider, if you will.
So to wrap things up, your perspective on artificial intelligence, share your holistic view of how you see it going forward in the problem that you're trying to solve.
I think artificial intelligence is something that the way that we're approaching it is it being a force multiplier with these providers. So extending their reach, making sure that they're more efficient in what they do, and giving them tools that prior to AI were unattainable for them to achieve. And I think we're already doing that, but I think that we're at the tip of the iceberg here in really what we can do for providers moving forward. My number one thing that we have to be cognizant of is patient safety in this mix. And I say safety from both a clinical perspective, but also data security perspective. And we talk to a lot of hospitals and payers and make sure that everything that we're doing and they're doing is aligned with in terms of when things are flagged, that is clinically efficacious, and that everything is secure and treated as such, just like your health records would be. And I'm optimistic that we're going to do that. we just need to, as a industry, not just Neuroflow, make sure that AI is used intelligently and not, we don't bite off more than we could chew.
Very good. I like that military term, force multiplier. That's a great way of thinking of it. It really is. This has been great, Chris. Your expertise in whole personal care, what you're doing with Neuroflow, I know there's such a high demand for this, and the tools are finally starting to leverage to a solution process that we'll all benefit from. So our guest today, Chris Malero, CEO and co-founder of Neuroflow. Thank you, Chris, for being with us on the business of AI and healthcare.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's G-O-P-I, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.